Well, the bottom line is we all just want to be happy. I say, everybody just wants to be happy. All 7 billion humans and all sentient beings, in fact, animal realm too. Hungry ghosts also want to be happy. Hell beings and even the devas that are pretty happy in the celestial realms, they want their happiness to last even longer. Some people don't like the word happiness. They feel like it's too too happy. Yeah, that people some would rather call it like just peace or contentment. I think that's okay too. Same, I would say. Contentment, fulfillment, ease. Gratitude is maybe a quality of this also. And it sometimes looks like some people, we might look at some people and what they're doing and think, and look like, actually it looks like they don't really want to be happy. They're torturing themselves or they're giving up their own happiness for others, it might look like. But, I would still propose that that makes them happy. It's really like the bottom line. And I think it's beautiful when we discover that bringing happiness to others brings happiness to ourselves. It's kind of like the Bodhisattva path. I was thinking of the Bodhisattva vow, and we sometimes say, like, I vow not to become a Buddha until all beings are completely relieved of suffering. And we could say Buddha means like completely happy. So we could say it's like, I vow not to be completely happy until all beings are happy. But I think it's just these bodhisattvas who think such a way, what basically they've just realized, it's not even so much a vow, it's more like they've just realized that they can't be completely happy until everybody is happy. Or they can't be completely at peace until everybody's at peace. Which I think is true. It's not so much like a particular vow of a particular kind of being. It's more they've just realized the reality. This is how it is, yeah. Yeah. My teacher, Tenzin Roshi, sometimes would say, Bodhisattvas are very happy, but they their happiness is slightly dented. It's dented by the fact that not everyone is completely happy. And so I think it comes from the reality of seeing how we're really not separate. So if we realize that more and more deeply, we see that we can't have like me happy separate being and others not. It's not how it is. We want to be in accord with reality, which is that we're not separate. And mostly what we do, us sentient beings, is we look for happiness in the so-called objective world of objects. Something, we look for this fulfillment or contentment, fulfilling ourself with something outside of ourself, seemingly outside of ourself, which kind of stems from the view or understanding that there is something outside of ourself that's not ourself, that if we were to have it, we would be then fulfilled or complete. It's just almost like the definition of a sentient being, as I understand it. And so we look for the fulfillment or happiness through the acquisition of material things or relationships or even different mental states, better mental states. Even they are like, actually, I would say, objects of experience. And I think there's nothing wrong with this. It's the normal thing that we do. And actually, it kind of works, I would say. It works temporarily. We do find a kind of happiness. And I don't know, we could investigate this point of sometimes when we really want something or some relationship or some mental state, and we get it completely, that may be even a moment of complete happiness or complete fulfillment. Some might argue it's not really complete because in the back of our mind we know that it's just so fleeting. But I don't know, maybe we could say it's complete, but it's temporary, right? It's, in fact, it's only a moment, or maybe a series of moments. And then our habitual sentient mind, it kind of wears off, and the mind looks for something else to fulfill itself. So, and as we base our lives around this, right? And I think this is just normal. It's nothing wrong with, and I think I like to do this too, to have these moments of fulfillment. And at the same time, we could say from a spiritual perspective, in all traditions, I think, there's this potential that's proposed that there can be a more reliable and lasting happiness and fulfillment that is both lasting and reliable and more inclusive, like it includes the happiness of all beings, and it's in accord with reality, which this other type of temporarily fulfilling is a little bit like buying into the delusion of separation and duality. And again, it kind of works to buy into the illusion, so we continue to do it, but then there's this other, I don't think it negates the first one. It's not like the Buddhas don't like enjoy a good meal or good relationships, right? It's just that there can be this bigger, all-encompassing fulfillment also. And we might say, maybe people outside of the realm of practice might say, that's impossible dream to have everlasting, reliable, unchanging happiness and fulfillment and peace. But I think that is the proposal of any authentic spiritual tradition, actually. And then there's degrees of how much we open to that reality. And we might say, this thing of like, I want the total and everlasting happiness, we might say is like the pinnacle of self-centeredness or selfishness. We might hear it that way, but I would say actually, no, it's the most beautiful wish. Even the misguided wish to be happy through the acquisition of objects is still, I think, actually a beautiful thing. It might be like a little bit misguided, but it's beautiful because it's moving towards reality, which is, it's the wish to accord with the reality of complete fulfillment that we already are. And we're just doing it in a slightly confused way. So the Buddha, I think, before he was the so-called Buddha, I think this is what it looks like. We might say, that was so selfish. He was a prince. He had a great family. He had all the material things he could want. So selfish to want more. Right? And yet we could see it as the exact opposite, more like, I'm looking for this complete fulfillment and an inherent fulfillment that is a bigger, more all-encompassing fulfillment than everything I have in this life. And if I find that, maybe then I can share that with others. Which did work out that way. So I think wanting to be happy is actually a noble wish, and it's a wish in accord with reality. And again, the bodhisattvas have realized that their happiness must include the contentment and fulfillment of all beings. And so then we try to find ways to practice to help ourselves and others find this. And sometimes it's in the objective world. Sometimes it's somebody's sick and we give them medicine. Somebody's hungry, we give them food. And that fulfills them temporarily, and therefore it fulfills us temporarily. And this, I think, also is in accord with reality. It's beautiful. And at the same time, we can keep looking for this unconditioned fulfillment of all beings. One of my favorite metaphors for how this compassion of bodhisattvas works is, it's like a child who is scared in the dark and thinks there's a monster in the closet. When I was growing up, I actually had this illustrated kids book that I still remember the pictures, called There's a Nightmare in My Closet. I think it's Maurice Sendak. And it turns out that the nightmare in the book is actually this big, giant creature, and it looks very scary, I think it makes friends with the kid in the end. So we think there's a nightmare in my closet. There's a child may have this fear. And the mother, who is, in this metaphor is like the bodhisattva, wants the child to be happy and at ease and fulfilled. So she tries various skillful means, and they're based on the fact that actually this bodhisattva has realized this larger kind of more unconditioned happiness or fearlessness. So when the child comes running and to mother's arms, there's a monster in the closet, the mother doesn't get all terrified. She goes, oh my God, let's run. The mother says, well, let's check. Kid says, no, no, no. So mother courageously, because she is actually not afraid that there is a monster there. She knows that there isn't, because she is in accord with reality. She knows there is no monster there, really. So she goes and opens the closet with the kid hiding behind her. See, there's no monster. And it relieves the child a little bit. But I can remember this kind of thing as a child. Like, mom can look in all the closets and it relieves the fear somewhat, but not completely. Well, maybe as soon as you close the closet, it went back in there again. Maybe you have to check several times, and still we don't trust. And this is, I think, part of our practice path is to look for the monster in the closets where we think it might be and confirm that it's not there. And I think our practice is like this, like, look for the problem in the ocean of awareness and confirm that there is no problem separate from the ocean of awareness. It's just contained within it. But it seems like, we can confirm at once and be somewhat relieved, but then immediately the doubt comes up again. I don't know if that proved it really. So we have to look again and again and again. And keep, if we keep looking and not finding it, that's more and more relieving. We could take this metaphor even further, that even after checking the closet numerous times, the child is still feels not completely at ease. And then the mother, instead of like doing this more like this checking thing, the method of, you could almost say like reasoning or inquiry, this kind of method, helping the child to check again and again. Okay, then the mother's going to resort to, that works to some extent at this point for the child, but not completely. So then the mother says, I'll try another method that's even more simple than this checking, which is to just like be the fearlessness of the monster. The mother is just like, okay, well, maybe there is or maybe there isn't a monster, but just you come here and like I'll just hold you, and you can, and the child in the fearless, content mother's arms naturally just kind of accords with that and falls asleep peacefully. Almost like two different methods, right? One is checking the helping the child to check the closet. Like, you can stand behind me, I'll check for you. And then the other one is, okay, we don't have to do anything here, but I will be remembering my true nature of fearless contentment and fulfillment, and you just be with me in this reality. She doesn't even say that, right? She just is that way with the child. And it's like osmosis. So that can be a part of the Bodhisattva's way of benefiting beings, is basically to just accord with reality ourself. Again, people might say, that sounds selfish. You're just doing this silent sitting, and you're just being the peace of this present, unborn, inherently peaceful awareness. How does that help anyone? But like in this metaphor, it's pretty helpful to just be that way around those who are not at peace. There's, at the same time that we're sitting here today, downtown at the Wisdom Center, a few minutes from here, there's another weekend retreat. Some people are sitting all day today and tomorrow. But instead of sitting silently, they're reciting the mantra of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva all day long. Corinne and I went last night and started some mantras with them. And so it's a compassion retreat. The method there is just to stay present. It's just to quietly recite this mantra that kind of gets in touch with this Bodhisattva of great compassion. But the instructions, there were very simple instructions given by the teacher there for how to practice this weekend. Said, you know, you're doing the mantra, but the basic things to keep in mind, don't worry so much how it sounds or anything, but keep this mind of compassion, this heart of compassion, which is just like open-heartedness. And we might say, it's this remembering that we are not separate and we cannot be completely fulfilled until everyone's fulfilled. So we wish, just like we wish for our own happiness, we wish for the happiness and non-suffering of all beings. See, that's compassion. It's called the Wisdom Center. It just opened a couple months ago, right near Mobo Sushi near Inside Santa Cruz, same building maybe?
Galleria.
The Galleria. And it's shared by various Buddhist groups, yeah, mostly Tibetan Buddhist groups. So the instructions were to keep this heart of compassion and devotion to Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of great compassion. And we might say, one way to look at that would be, the Bodhisattva of great compassion, his or her essence and nature is this boundless, ever-present, inherently all-embracing, unborn, undying awareness right now. Ordinary awareness right now that includes everybody and everything. So devotion to that, that is Avalokiteshvara, actually. It's also Manjushri Bodhisattva and Shakyamuni Buddha. We talk about their different qualities, but their nature is, of course, it's all the same, and it's the same as our nature. It's Buddha nature. But sometimes we look at how this unborn, all-encompassing, ever-present awareness is pure wisdom of non-duality, and sometimes we emphasize this ever-present, unborn, undying awareness as it is complete love and compassion, unconditional love and compassion, because nobody is separate from it. We share this one mind. And if anyone is suffering due to feeling separate from this one awareness, or we wish to include them back into this which we all share. So sometimes we call it compassion. So devotion to that is like, I think a little bit different from just the heart of compassion, maybe is the more, at least the way I'm hearing it or thinking of it now, is compassion is just remembering the suffering of beings. It's more like remembering this conventional appearance of how different beings are have lost touch with their true nature and therefore are looking for fulfillment in something outside. We feel this heart of, and ourself is part of this too, we feel compassion for ourselves because we might be looking for something outside, like something a little bit better zazen period today, or a little bit more comfortable sitting or whatever, something that's not complete right now. And we know many, when we feel that non-completeness, we know many others share this with us. And we wish for the fulfillment without moving a particle, without changing the external conditions in the slightest. We wish for the remembrance and recognition of our true nature. And so that's the compassion part. And then the devotion to this is like, this is how all beings will be free. This is how we can be happy unconditionally. I am devoted to Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, which is my unborn awareness and your unborn awareness that we all share. That's, in a way, that's the more deeper, ultimate remembrance of how we can be free. Compassion's more the way I'm thinking of it now. Compassion's more like remembering all these different beings who are suffering, and let's vow to include them in this love that we are. And then the devotion is devotion to this love that we are. So we can join the other practitioners downtown today, and they'll be doing it through some, speech expression, and we'll be doing it through some silent expression. We're all sitting together. Yes.
At 2, the schedule, a Tara dance is scheduled at 2 o'clock, and that is representing an offering to the teacher for his commitment to the Sangha and his bringing of the teaching. And there is a poster on the bulletin board that has a complete schedule and identifies what's happening. There'll be plenty of mantra recitation.
And I would encourage everybody who is planning to be here this afternoon to go down there instead. But if you're around in the evening, there's an evening session from 7 to 9 after the sitting and all day tomorrow.
Till 4.
Yeah. Any other questions, comments? Yes?
So, I hope I'm not missing the last thing, but one thing that's arising for me during that was it's a little bit different schedule. So I'm like, I've had a coffee today. And I'm thinking about what you're saying a little bit about checking for monsters. And I'm thinking, and this is a very mundane sort of thing that I'm experiencing, maybe much more mundane than what you're speaking of. But it's like, I wonder if it would be appropriate as an investigation to be like, is it really monstrous, this feeling, to be without coffee? In a way?
Yeah. No, that is what I'm talking about. That's the kind of monster. I mean, it takes, you know, many, many kinds of monsters. One of my teachers calls them beautiful monsters. We have to let's investigate all our beautiful monsters. Because they're beautiful because when we start looking for what they are, we see that they are actually just appearances or expressions of this unborn, ever-present awareness. They're nothing other than it. Therefore, they're very beautiful. And yeah, that's exactly it. We look for happiness in external things. So we think of, sometimes we think of those, you know, objective things like possessions or people or something. But I think often it's mind states. We're looking for different mind states, better mind states. And one of them is, if we haven't had coffee, is the mind state of like being a little bit more like awake and here and not kind of like dull and kind of craving coffee. So we look for the fulfilled state of having imbibed some coffee.
Even if my manifestation of my desire for coffee is based on the fact that I have a small headache. And so I wonder if even then we would call that a beautiful monster.
There's no exceptions. There are in this from this perspective, there are no ugly monsters. They're all beautiful, and we could also from this perspective. We could even say that every experience, the post-coffee mind state and the pre-coffee mind state are both kind of monsters, and they're both beautiful. They're both, they're just different experiences and different mind states. And I mean, this is, I think, maybe that's part of the problem with the word happiness, is because happiness can sound like another mind state. But the happiness I'm speaking of is the more like the inherent, unchanging happiness that's actually not a mind state. So maybe the word is questionable, but you could say like the inherent fulfillment that everything, that reality is completely fulfilled beginninglessly and endlessly, which we sometimes call the self fulfilling samadhi, and that can be also translated as the self-fulfilled samadhi. The self here, capital S, is the all-inclusive, unborn, undying, ever-present awareness is our true nature. It's our true self. And it is always fulfilled because it includes everything and it lacks nothing. And so when we practice that this self-fulfilled samadhi, it's more like we're just according with what already is. It's almost like it's not really a practice. One could even say the practice of self-fulfilling or self-fulfilled samadhi is just ceasing all other practices. Ceasing all practices. Ceasing doing anything to fix or improve what's happening right now, based on the understanding that what's happening now is completely fulfilled. This pre-coffee state is lacks nothing whatsoever. Because when we see this state of mind, that's like a little bit of a headache and a little bit of sleepiness at the same time. What seems so unfulfilled, when we see that basically like feeling and mental state, it's kind of like a feeling thought combination, the pre-coffee state. When we really like kind of settle into that and see and investigate that, we see that it is just, well, that state is just the awareness of a mind state. It's the awareness of a headache and tiredness. It's the experiencing of a headache and tiredness. It's the knowing of a headache and tiredness. And we can't find, when we really settle deeply into our direct experience, apropos, we can't find a headache and a tiredness other than the experiencing of them. We can't find a headache and a tiredness other than the awareness or the knowing of them. They are the knowing of them. There are actually no mind states other than the experiencing of them. And that's non-duality. To be just the experiencing with no objects, to be this awareness that includes what we call these mind states and includes sounds and colors and feelings of hunger and headache and emotions and thoughts, that all of that is just the experiencing of it. And the experiencing, the knowing, the awareness, we call it unborn because it didn't begin at some time. I mean, we can't find any time when it began. If we were to find a time, that would be an experience. That would be a state. If we could find an end, that would be a state. If we could find some change in the awareness, that would be like a changing state. The awareness is unchanging. Yes?
I'm thinking of some conversations I've had recently, and your teaching right now is helping me see the subtleties of when I begin to say to these people that my number one passion is consciousness. And then I stop myself because I'm really wondering, is it? By my behavior and my thinking, you know, it seems like it's taken a little bit of a back step. But what I'm seeing here is that there's a little bit of negativity, or that's bad, that's not good, or
to have that be your priority.
That I'm not good enough. Hmm. It's got weight. That was supposed to be my commitment, and I'm falling.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So what if we say that, like, we're never lying if we all say that our number one priority, did you say priority?
Uh-huh.
Our number one priority is happiness. No one can say, no, I don't think you really want that. You forget that sometimes. We could say, that's why I say the bottom line, and nobody can accuse us of faking that. I propose this really is, no matter how much we even try to fake it, we can't escape. This is our number one priority. And then we can say, maybe say for myself, then my second priority is to remember the most real and true way to have this true happiness, and we might call that consciousness or awareness. I might say, but then because I'm just so into happiness that sometimes I'll like put that one aside and just get into like having a good meal. and then hopefully with no regrets. I mean, sometimes I can.
Or trying to make money.
It's part of it too. Right? And then, but all that's okay. It's just, I think it's more like when we forget the big one, the most reliable one, the one that can be actually a refuge. Refuge meaning like I place my trust and security in this type of happiness because this is the one that will never fail me because it never can go anywhere. It's ever present. We got to keep remembering that, and if we get too caught up in like, really, like, that doesn't really matter because it doesn't pay the bills, then, and I got to pay the bills, that's the highest priority, then it is, I think, good to remember the priorities. But, and like you pointed out, then not to judge ourselves for forgetting, because we all do this. To see if we can remember that the forgetting itself is actually another manifestation of the unborn awareness. Which is one of the most amazing things, that reality, it's not exactly that it chooses, right, but that reality is willing to obscure itself and therefore create what we call suffering or discontent. So strange. And as people like to ask, why does it do that? And we will not answer this question. But it does seem to do this, doesn't it? Therefore we have dharma and practice. Yes?
I'm thinking what the Buddha offered us is I have this image of the North Star. I mean, whether we get to the North Star isn't the point. That's the direction. Your happiness is a way, is a path. It emerges from you and it goes in that direction. Because I think it's, for my mind, it's a little hard to imagine the state of ultimate bliss existing in the Buddha over there, who came, you know, I don't know how to relate to that, or that he would hand out bliss, you know, cookies to all his disciples. But he just said, this is the way. This is always the way. Whenever you're lost at night, look for the North Star.
And what is the North Star?
Well, all of the things you've been saying this morning, that practice of bringing to mind this beautiful object, which is so subtle.
Remembering. Mm-hmm. And it's not really even the object, really, right? It is the source of all objects.
Yeah, it's impossible to put words.
Yeah, and it's not exactly a state, right?
Yeah.
A state of bliss. It is the knowing of all states, the experiencing of all states, is inherently blissful. Again, some people, the word can be tricky because then we're looking for some ecstatic feeling state, whereas it's more like bliss, and I've heard that the word bliss, like ananda, or sukha in Sanskrit, can also, they have this nuance of just complete fulfillment. So I think that's a nice way of emphasizing that it's not a particular, maybe like excited state. We often think of bliss as super excited, like bliss, but it's more just like it completely fulfilled. And we're talking about this reality of awareness that's inherently always completely fulfilled, because fulfilled just means that it lacks nothing.
Well, I guess my,
and we could call that bliss.
Mm. Yeah, the gift that I feel is this thought form or this practice or this sutra material that constantly is available to bring you back to a way that's directed toward happiness.
Mm-hmm.
From any circumstance, it's always toward happiness.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether we get to heaven, we don't get to the North Star. You know, we don't. That's not what it's.
Well, in this way, it's more like, if we set up the North Star as something distant that we're aiming towards, I know what you mean, and at the same time, that can be. It could be misleading, because then we think that there's some end state where what we're talking about is this awareness right now that's already fulfilled and lacks nothing because there's nothing outside itself. It includes everything. So by its very definition, it can't lack anything. What it is the totality of everything.
Well, I would say what it is you're reminding us.
That's more like the path part, right? Yes. That's more like the practice in the path, you could say, is remembering, recognizing, recognizing.
It's just a little...
Yeah. Little, and it's a direction in the sense that... we're aiming for... the reality that already is. So aiming or direction can have a misleading thing. And if we ever put it like, set up a kind of goal of a state to, complete in the future, I think that very kind of thinking can be a hindrance to being it right now. I think it's maybe just so obvious, but, even if we think about the Buddha's complete awakening, complete Buddhahood, to think that when that happens to a Buddha or to us, it will always happen now. It cannot happen in the future. And it might be like, we might feel like, oh, well, I don't feel in touch with that now. And there might be some other time like, oh, yes, I feel in touch with that. And at the time, we know that at the time when we're in touch with it, that time is called now. And when we are in touch with it, we realize that all the previous times that we felt we weren't in touch with it, we were actually it. Right? So I think it's good to remember this. It's easy to kind of set it up as some future thing. And sometimes, I think I have done this, and... I see it's this possibility of by putting this realization as something in the future, it's a way to protect myself, my small self, habitual being. Like, that's such a noble ideal, and I'm totally down with it, you know, and I have no complaint about that realization. I do want that, and like, I'm gonna do it. In a way, that whole story can be like a kind of like, but not right now. You know, meanwhile, I like need some coffee. So, yes.
Well, I'm originally from the Southern Hemisphere, so I look to the Southern Cross, a different direction. But, I did experience a kind of guiding when in Australia, in the central desert, at the place that used to be called Ayers Rock and is now known as Uluru, the Aboriginal name. And I think it's a metaphor for some of what we've been talking about. As you probably know, many people who visit Uluru want to climb it. It's a huge sacred boulder, sacred to the people who are the original owners there. But many of us who come from the West want to achieve this idea that we have conquered it, we have climbed it. And so many people purchase t-shirts that say, I climbed Uluru. But the Aboriginal people, the traditional owners, as they're called, who have only just recently been able to establish the rules and give the directions for how to approach Uluru, always said that, no, you must walk around it. You circumambulate if you wish to meet the reality of this sacred place, which is what you can also do if you go there. You can go with Aboriginal leaders who will show you how this is done and in what mood. It's like our practice. Well, only recently an agreement was reached between the Australian government and the traditional owners, and very soon no one will climb Uluru anymore. Everyone will have to walk around and be guided according to the directions and under the Southern Cross. And that way, I'm impressed by the great patience and generosity of these Aboriginal people who have suffered so, as we know, for so long. But with their patience and their desire to show us how we might be happier and suffer less, in other words, stop wanting to climb the thing and conquer it and prove that we've done it, but rather bring us in accord with what is, we will now be able to approach it in that manner.
Nice. That is a great metaphor.
Yes.
For this. Similarly, the Bodhi tree in India that the Buddha sat under, when I first went to India, it has this fence around it, but all day the fence would be open and you could go up and you could hug the tree. And now it's just always locked. Which is kind of nice, right? Because people thought they could even get a little piece of bark of the tree or climb the tree. And now you can just walk around it. Yeah. Yeah, so, which relates to, can we get the bliss of nirvana, climb it and conquer it and get it? That very thinking is what makes it into an object separate from what's happening now. It's something other than this, whereas it's more like to...
Also, it occurred to me that the Aboriginal people's dream time is something like the unborn, all-encompassing, grounded realm.
Dream time.
With no beginning, no end, and everything included in
it.
And it's, yes,
yeah.
It's from that understanding that they teach us how to enter their space.
Yeah, and around... We say, turning away and touching are both wrong. So turning away would be like, if I can't climb it, then I'm just going home.
Yes.
No, we can stay close, walk around, but to touch it or try to climb it or conquer it, is they're both wrong. For it is like a massive fire. Uluru is like a massive fire. The unborn awareness is like a massive fire, which is a line celebrating what we call Jewel Mirror Samadhi, which of course is just another name for the self-fulfilled samadhi, like a jewel mirror, precious mirror that equally reflects everything and is never changes as the reflections it manifests come and go. Yes.
What do we call when we read this book, the format and the form?
formless awareness?
The mother is the formless awareness?
Yeah,
I mean, you could say that, I think. I was thinking it more like the bodhisattva on the path to saving all beings, freeing all beings from suffering, is like the mother. Like one, you know, could be an actual person who's trying to help the frightened child with these different methods. But also, I think you're right that we could say it goes together, because what is a bodhisattva really? They look like a person who's trying to help, but their true nature is this formless awareness. And totally deluded, confused, harmful sentient beings, their true nature is also this formless awareness. It's just, say, the bodhisattvas are just more in touch with it. More. They remember it more often. Even the totally confused sentient beings, I think even they remember it sometimes. And maybe, this is maybe an unusual way to say it, at the moment of fulfillment, even in just conventional fulfillment, like you're tired, you have the headache, and then you drink the cup of coffee, and you feel like, that's exactly what I needed. Everything is fine and complete right now. The world is good after this cup of coffee. I would say, propose that moment of complete fulfillment, having had the cup of coffee, that is recognizing the formless awareness. And that's you don't really usually find that in the sutras. The Buddha is so into trying to get the cup of coffee is so distracting from the project at hand that he kind of disses getting the cup of coffee in especially the early sutras. But and I think that's just a skillful method of just don't worry about the coffee, remember this. But maybe that the moment of total fulfillment and completion and drinking the coffee is a little taste of our true nature, the unborn awareness. It's like our conventional life is completely in accord with this inherently fulfilled awareness. Everything's aligned but the problem is that it's only a moment. It's only temporarily aligned, and then it seems to divide up again. And the dualistic mind thinks we start to feel the headache again, and we forget that the headache is already fulfilled. So we're like, I can only be fulfilled in a headache-free state, and then we go off into the distance looking for the cup of coffee at the end of the rainbow. Okay.
I think that to establish that relationship with objects which temporarily is really challenging for people.
Yes, yeah.
I find
to honor them. I think that, again, the Buddha talked about, I think he saw the danger, and he talked about, he used the word danger, I think, in sense pleasure, for example. He said it's like trying to, pick up a knife by the blade. So he kind of makes it sound danger, like a negative thing, but I think he's saying it's just dangerous because it's so addictive. We just want to keep getting it again. Uh-huh. But you're right. We want right relationship is like totally enjoy, pick up the knife carefully,
yeah.
Totally enjoy it.
Yeah.
And then, but don't invest our true happiness in it.
And
yeah.
What
it's just tricky.
What I see and what I do myself sometimes is hold back.
Yeah.
Just partially.
Yeah.
Enjoy it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's true.
I'm safe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous. And I see it in different manifestations.
I think you're right, yeah.
Wholesale among other
Yeah. Yep. And
yeah.
And also because maybe we feel guilty about being so happy.
Yeah, the guilt is right there.
Yeah. And this part of the bodhisattva path is, I think this is also a common misunderstanding of the bodhisattva path is, I shouldn't really feel okay if others are suffering. As a good bodhisattva, this dented happiness thing is like, God, remember my dent. Whereas I would say more like, the dent is a natural thing because we're not separate. And we don't need to like, if we feel like, I feel too happy and I might stray from the bodhisattva path, so where's my dent? Oh yeah, those suffering beings. Okay, now I feel not so good. Good. So, that actually, it's a tricky point. Because I think bodhisattvas, like this mother in the story, if she started buying into the child's fear, like, maybe there really is a monster. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's all messed up. And then they're both sunk, right? Whereas, but not buying into doesn't mean not totally holding this child and feeling, I was thinking about that metaphor too of like, it could seem a little bit aloof, like I'm not afraid at all, but like I'll hold the suffering child. Sometimes if the child feels that separation, sometimes then the mother maybe is like, I really feel your fear too. Or sometimes the mother even feels some fear and like, well, let's be afraid together is also okay. But this, to enjoy enjoyment when it's there and to almost like register, this is what nirvana is like, but except that this one is conditioned by this particular state or event. And I've heard that nirvana is unconditioned. It doesn't depend on the circumstances, but the quality of like ease and fulfillment and nothing missing is like to really bask in that, uh-huh. and enjoy that and want it in a more and more unconditioned way.
To recognize it participates in that.
Yeah, it participates in.
What comes to mind for me when you're speaking about the enjoyment of things or mm-hmm. Is that whole. I don't remember what chant this comes from, but being actualized by myriad things.
Yeah.
For me, is so that comes up all the time because I feel such gratitude that there's no separation.
Yeah.
Oh, that there's this lemon that I'm picking from my tree. That
is it
allows me to be.
Yeah.
All the myriad things take.
It is all part of you.
We do participate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They really take. If we take them like that, that they take care of us, then it is the mother child.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a way, conventionally, we have to Good to clarify, what do we mean by us or me in this case? We could say me as like this body and mind has a relationship with the apple and so on and other people. In that way we take care of each other in this conventional sense. But me, not as the body and mind, but me as the all-encompassing awareness, you could say in a way that it's not so much that other things take care of that. We could say it that way, but more like other things are it. There is no differentiation. I am this unborn awareness, and when we look for the objects of awareness, we see that they are the awareness of them. Therefore, I am you, and you are me, and we are three, and we are all together. Okay, last question.
You said something earlier that was really interesting also in describing the monster. You're talking about the child feeling the fearlessness of the monster.
Oh.
I wasn't sure if you meant the empathetic, like, feeling what...
I probably meant the fearlessness of the mother.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, I maybe misspoke.
I see.
The fearlessness of the mother. And that's what actually, like, helps the child. The mother being the fearless bodhisattva, because she knows that there is no monster. She's fearless, and the child, you know, gets that, feels that, even without the mother saying anything. That's the kind of osmosis part. And, but we could extend it just for fun also and say, the beautiful monsters are themselves also fearless, because their nature is this ever-present knowing awareness. It's the nature of everything. Monsters and mothers and children and closets and coffee and lemons and Uluru.
is there a monster in the closet in the story?
In the Maurice Sendak book? Mm-hmm. As I recall, it's like there is a this big kind of gray, gnarly creature. Do you know that book?
Yeah.
And it kind of comes, and it's way bigger than the child, but I think they walk off like hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they become friends.
Yeah, they become friends. The Buddha and Mara walk off hand in hand, because the Buddha is like, I know who you are, Mara, and Mara's like, I know who you are, Buddha. Now we know each other. We can be friends. So we'll keep sitting. We can talk more in the afternoon at tea. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.